It's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year?
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations? Forgotten. The history?
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
Welcome to the Terrible Podcast with your host from SteelersDepot.com, where you can find all your latest and greatest Steelers news. It's Dave Bryan and Alex Cazzora, always Lynn, talking Steelers. And now, here's Dave and Alex.
Welcome to the Terrible Podcast, Season 14, Episode 113. He's Dave Bryan. I'm Alex Cazzora, SteelersDepot.com. Thanks for being back with us here this Wednesday, Steelers Nation. Dave, how you doing?
I'm doing well. I have recovered from that loss yesterday by the Buccos to the Tigers. What a way to lose that one in the ninth with Bednar pitching and all like that. He hasn't had the best start of the season there, but
where do you come in on booing Bednar? Is that inbounds? Is that should we cut him some more slack? A little controversy in Pittsburgh right now.
I mean, look, yeah, that's a game that you should win. You have Bednar in there thinking, you know, that he's going to nail that thing down. It's not a you can be mad at the decision to leave him in a little bit longer than necessary. You can boo the actual performance and all of that. Yeah, I mean, I think it was worth booing. I was booing in my head, during that inning there. Look, I mean, he could come back out and be the same, what is he, two-time All-Star pitcher that he was or has been in the past there. But in that situation in the ninth, his job is to come in there and nail that thing down, and he didn't do it, so boo Bednar.
Oh, all right. I disagree. My hot take. Now, listen, people can do what they want. They paid for their ticket, but I am anti-boo. I will not boo a player. I was like 7 years old at a Pirates game booing Tony Armish Jr., who was a terrible starting pitcher for the Pirates, and I felt so bad for it. It's like Bednar knows he did a bad job. I don't have to boo Bednar to know that he did not do his job and succeed yesterday.
Yeah, well, if you don't want to boo, don't boo. Okay. If you want to boo, boo.
Sure.
You know? So
sure.
It's funny, you know, it's funny that has become such a look. I mean, they've gotten off to a great start, you know, but Bednar hasn't been himself, and I realize that he got a slow start in spring training and all like that. That's probably played into it, mm-hmm. and all like that. But that's a game that they should have won, you know.
Oh yeah, no question. Yeah, he's definitely not looked like himself, and maybe there's a IL stint coming. But anyway, to bring it back to the Pittsburgh Steelers again, news relatively slow so far, so can open up with some broader Pittsburgh talk here. Dave, where do you want to begin? We should mention here Pittsburgh losing one of its free agents. That's Miles Boykin signing a contract with the New York Giants. Don't know details of that deal. Likely a one-year deal for minimum type of value there. So Boykin, been with Pittsburgh the last 2 years, starting gunner, strong special teamer, a bit part offensively as a blocker in 13 personnel, 22 personnel run type of situations in groupings. Very little involvement in terms of receiver offensively, but Pittsburgh is losing a very, you know, competent and strong special teamer.
Be interesting to see the details of this. I don't think it's going to be astronomical, but it might be a little bit more than a veteran benefit contract as well. It's hard to envision the Steelers not having a veteran benefit contract, even maybe one without a sign, you know, $167,500 signing bonus on the table for Miles Boykin, basically an invitation to come back and compete and try to win his job again. I mean, would you be surprised to learn that they wouldn't have taken him back on at least a one-year deal like that?
Not really. My prediction was the Boykin would walk. I think Pittsburgh was looking for maybe a bit more offensive firepower at the bottom of its depth chart at wide receiver. You know, Boykin didn't sign until right before the draft last year. So it just kind of felt like eventually those guys you just move on from and you find the replacements, guys that are maybe a bit younger, a bit cheaper overall. So I wouldn't be terribly surprised. I mean, maybe he had an offer, but I would not be surprised if Pittsburgh just said, thank you, Miles, and best of luck to you.
All right. But yeah, I mean, for him to sign at this point in the offseason with the Giants, once again, I don't think this is going to be an astronomical deal, but it might be, you know, if anything, there might be a $167,500 signing bonus involved in this. Maybe something that if the Steelers did offer him, maybe they didn't offer him that bonus and maybe just a minimal contract there. But look, the big storyline here isn't necessarily, you know, the loss of him. It's the loss of what he does and does well. And that's play gunner on special teams. That now means that this team has lost both of their gunners from last year in Miles Boykin and James Pierre. And, you know, a lot of people think that you and I put way too much emphasis on special teams, but that's part of roster construction. We spent a lot of time during training camp and 53-man roster predictions of making sure we cover special teams and the importance of that there. So now you've lost two of your starting gunners from last season. They've got to replace those. You would think maybe a guy like Darius Rush will have an opportunity to do that, and, you know, somebody else, obviously. Maybe it'll be a wide receiver down on a depth chart. Maybe it'll be a rookie. Who knows there? But was that the best set of gunners this team has had in quite a while?
I mean, you could send me down a rabbit hole for a couple hours talking about Steelers special teams and gunners. You think about Chidi Iwuma and Sean Morey back in the mid early 2000s and the great duo that those guys were and the strong specialists they had with them and Clint Creedwald, et cetera. But it was certainly, I think, a really good pairing in Pierre and Boykin. And when camp rolls around, the focus will be on any quarterback battle between Wilson and Fields and maybe a center competition and whatever other battles pop up and rookies and establishing their footing and stronghold on the roster. But I'll be watching the gunners because those are roster spots up for the taking. And you talk about, you know, the last guy that can make that spot is the 53rd guy or 52nd guy. There's going to be an opportunity for some young guys. You mentioned Darius Rush. We saw Des Fitzpatrick make the practice squad last year because of what he did inside stadiums as a coverage guy, as a gunner. As you said, rookies will probably come in, have an opportunity. So that's going to be a big change. And we know gunners are important. We know kick returns are going to be more active this year. So beyond even just the gunner aspect, Boykin, Pierre playing on kick coverage as they did the last couple seasons, they're going to have to find replacements for them as well. So in a vacuum, is losing Pierre and Boykin a major loss? No, obviously not, but losing both and having to replace both with, you know, probably two more unknown guys in that gunner role is something certainly worth watching.
Right. All right. That's a good 5 minutes on that. People probably didn't want us to spend 2 minutes on it, but there we go.
Listen, it's a hill we're going to die on because I'll talk special teams. I did a long snapper scouting report yesterday. Ooh. So you want to learn about Joe Shimko from NC State, really undersized, but a really strong long snapper. Go check out SeaglessDepot.com.
All right, where to?
Let's talk pre-draft visitors, as Pittsburgh has been loading up on the visits this week. And true to form, about half hour after our podcast there Monday, Dave, some visitors came in. One was already known, though, in Max Melton. One unknown, though, in defensive lineman Logan Lee from Iowa, who's got some size, lacking length, and part of that rotational system that Iowa has. And then yesterday, the team bringing in two more players, wide receiver A.D. Mitchell, height, weight, speed, freak, potential first-round pick. He was in for a visit, and also defensive lineman Jaden Crumity from Mississippi State, who's viewed as a day-three type of guy, but kind of checks the height, weight, length box that Pittsburgh has been trying to look for, becoming tougher to find. Also reportedly, I think later this week, don't know the exact date on this, that likely first-round pick offensive tackle Troy Fontenot will come in for a visit as well. So Pat Meyer at that Washington Pro Day at the end of March. Now Fontenot coming in for a visit. That is certainly notable when you talk about first-round possibilities.
Yeah, it is. And the thing about A.D. Mitchell, finally got to go back around and dive a little bit deeper into his film. And the thing with him that you know, if it weren't for a couple of the guys that are obviously, you know, Rome Odunze and Marvin Harrison and Neighbors, those guys are in my opinion clear top of that position group in the class. But in any other, you know, class, you know, where would AD Mitchell probably rank? probably could, you know, in several other previous classes there, you could probably be the number one overall receiver. I really enjoy taking a deeper dive into his tape. He is a guy that catches the football down the field more, got a nice average depth of target, average depth of completion, can get down the field, can make an occasional combative catch. He really tracks the football really well down the field. He does a really good job with his route running, especially in stuff where he's asked to do some curls and some comebacks. Really has a plan of setting defensive backs up. He got a nice catch radius overall. I think he catches with his hands nicely when it's called for. Doesn't seem to be a lot of drops or anything on his tape overall. I haven't gone into the blocking aspect of him. If there's one thing that probably might be dinged with him, is probably that even though he's a big boy overall, just the frame and all like that. More on this, on the skinnier side, not you know, not that thick of a guy. So you do kind of wonder what his blocking would be. But overall, a nice prospect. And, you know, depending on the run of wide receivers and when they happen, is he a guy that could go in the first round? Yeah, I think so. Towards the end of it there, more than anything, it feels like he is a guy that would be off the board, though, by the time the Steelers pick in the second round, based on me kind of going deeper into his tape. Mm-hmm.
That does seem true. Again, it's hard to know which receiver will fall. Somebody's going to fall. You're not going to have 13 receivers go in the top 35 selections. Just from a need standpoint, those guys will get pushed down. The question is who and how far, but I don't think that Mitchell will go all the way to 51, but you play the Blues Clues game, and there's certainly been a lot of interest in AD Mitchell. You had Zach Zonnie at his pro day, and Texas has three potential draftable wide receivers this year: Xavier Worthy and AD Mitchell, who could both be first round picks or no worse than probably top 40 type of guys. And then even Jordan Whittington, who's going to be late round guy, undrafted free agent, kind of on that border there, is a big slot type. So a lot of talent there, Texas wide receiver this year. But yeah, Mitchell, I mean, you probably studied this game a bit more than I have. It just seems like he doesn't always quite play to that frame and that size and that potential and upside. He's got to be a bit more consistent of a guy, a bit more detailed guy. And there's probably a level of rawness to his game. Really a one-year production guy too. He was at Georgia with George Pickens and then transferred to Texas, had a big 2023, but it is 1 year. In some ways, it is a little Pickens-like, because it's kind of like 1 year production you're banking on the traits and the tools and the upside and trying to round out the edges in his game.
Yeah, I think the thing with him is, you know, he was used down the field so much. Imagine, you know, it's hard not to imagine him having success. And, you know, a lot of times we talk about this with Malachi Corley. You look at the average depth of target, average depth of completion with him, and you say, oh man, I sure would like to see more of that down the field stuff from him. Well, then on the flip side, you get to a guy like Mitchell, and you're asking to yourself, you know, the reverse thing here. So you're never really satisfied. It's hard to envision him, though, not being able to win in the shorter area. I think what he was asked to do, he was asked to do. That's how. And look, give me a guy that's got a nice tape selection of catching the football down the field. You know, because that's his yak. Probably is not there yards after the catch because of the fact that he was catching the ball down the field so much, you know, and really didn't have an opportunity really so much to add yards after the catch. But he's a pretty smooth guy overall. So what I'm getting at is if you did mix in more slants with him, more underneath, you know, shorter digs, out routes and all like that. You know, it's not hard envisioning him becoming a more complete wide receiver, especially in kind of an X type role overall there. So I would clearly rate, you know, and it's not, you know, a captain obvious statement here. I would clearly rank him as a higher receiver than I would Malachi Corley there. So that, you know, he's probably somewhere, I don't know, fourth, fifth, sixth overall in this wide receiver draft class. It depends on what flavor, you know, some teams are looking for. That's why I think he could be, I mean, is he in the conversation maybe for the Steelers at 20th overall? To me, that it feels like a little bit of a reach there. But I mean, I think he is a, I think the tape overall, you know, could put him in the first round somewhere there. And then on the flip side, though, it does feel like it would be, I mean, obviously you don't know how this thing, how, you know, how many wide receivers are going to go ahead of him and all like that. It does feel like a reach, though, for him to be still on the board by the time the Steelers pick in the second round. So it, you know, barring a trade down or something like that, or barring other guys going off the board where the Steelers maybe had penciled in at 20, it feels kind of a reach to see him go at 20 for the Steelers, though.
That always feels like the dilemma. It's a little too early for him at Pittsburgh's, you know, previous initial spot, and then it's a little too late for them at their next spot, and you're trying to find that line between where it makes sense overall. But if he's going to be the fourth receiver off the board, 20 in that sense would not be too high, I think, right, for a fourth receiver to come off the board. And yeah, I mean, after Marvin Harrison Jr., Malik Nabers, and Rome Odunze go in whichever order they are selected, it's kind of wide open who the next guy will be. It could be Mitchell, it could be Brian Thomas Jr., it could be, you know, maybe even Ricky Pearsall from Florida, if there's some extra buzz on him. I mean, this thing kind of gets wide open from there. And as you said, it's kind of different flavors and different styles. It could be his teammate, Xavier Worthy, if you want the pure speed aspect of the fastest player in combine history. So that'll become really interesting. I still think day two is where Pittsburgh will go with receiver based on the depth of the class, comments that Mike Tomlin's made, and the totality of the names they brought in for visits, which are typically more the day two type of guys. And just given their heavy interest in first round offensive linemen. So I don't think it'll be Mitchell, but you know, if there's a big run on tackle, let's say right before Pittsburgh's pick at 20, if they stay, then yeah, you can't rule out AD Mitchell.
Look, this is a position of need for this team. They still, I mean, yeah, look, I realize they've signed Van Jefferson and Quez Watkins, but those are not, in my opinion, those are not needle movers at this point. And then obviously you trade away a guy like Deontay Johnson, unknown, you know, rank the commodity however you want to rank the commodity, but at least it was known to you at that point. And you look at the rest of the wide receiver, you know, this, and that's why we're talking all off season, even before them trading away Deontay Johnson. We knew this team needed to go wide receiver. They did not address the position last year in the draft. So you know, now that you've traded away Deontay, that really makes that a position in need here overall.
You had the study though, interestingly, right? Longest streak.
That's where I'm going here. Is that a feature? Is that a what do you like to say? Is that a feature? Is that a?
It's not a bug. It's the feature.
You're right. It's not a bug. It's a feature. It's been set. They've gone 17 drafts without drafting a wide receiver in the first round. The last time that happened, obviously, was 2006 with Santonio Holmes, and he was the first wide receiver drafted in that draft. Mm. That year as well too. So you get the top, you know, the top position in that draft. But man, since then, 30 other teams have all drafted at least one wide receiver over the years in the first round. The only outstanding team other than the Steelers since 2006 not to draft a wide receiver at least once in the first round has been the Green Bay Packers. Look, the streak will be broken at some point, but my mind immediately went to why, you know, does the fifth-year option play in this? Does the fact that if you do get a good wide receiver in the first round and he does pan out, really, regardless of where you draft a guy, you know, a wide receiver, you could even get one in a sixth round. If he hits the ground running and really gets moving in this thing, after his third year, he's going to be hollering for a contract extension. And, you know, I guess where I'm going with this is the fifth year option when it comes to first round wide receivers and drafting them really a benefit at all? Because if you draft a wide receiver in the first round and he is who you think he is, then you're never going to come close to exercising the fifth year option, because these kids know now after the third year, I can get paid and I'm going to hold in. I'm going to cause problems. My position is a diva position anyway. You should expect it. Shame on you. Does any of that play into maybe some of the mentality? Now, look, once again, there are going to be wide receivers drafted in the first round this year. There's wide receivers drafted in the first round. But is that something that could shy a team away, like especially quote-unquote kind of cheaper teams like the Steelers and the Packers, right?
I don't think it has much of an influence. I mean, how long has the fifth-year option even been around? No, I mean, it's been a 17-year streak that it wasn't didn't exist.
Well, I mean, it started in it started with Cam Hayward's class, but you had to get to the fourth year, right? It came into in the 2011 CBA, right?
Yeah, after the lockout, but there's been some changes to the, obviously it's now, you know, fully guaranteed. If you do accept it by the date that it is accepted, it used to be kind of you could decline, you could accept it essentially early on. I mean, I don't think it's really, I don't see that as the reason, because for most positions, if you're hitting on that pick, you're paying that guy before the fifth year option. There are maybe some exceptions, running back, you know, maybe less so on offensive line, but generally if you've hit on the pick and hit big, he's never actually playing under that fifth year option. Maybe you get to the point where you pick it up, but he never actually plays under it because it's extension time.
Is it basically because where the Steelers have picked normally in the bottom half of the first round, and at that time you've got 3, 4, 5 wide receivers off the board, and then thus the positional value has shifted elsewhere? Is that really the root reason? That along with just, you know, randomness of drafts, is that a reason why they have not selected a wide receiver in the first round of a draft since 2006?
I think that's more likely. The premium receiver has that by the time you're picking at 20 or 23 or some years in the 30s, 31, 32, those receivers are gone. When you had Ben as well, you said, okay, we don't have to necessarily get the A-plus receiver. We can get the B receiver, and Ben's going to help make him an A receiver because we have a Hall of Fame quarterback throwing to him. I think that's a factor as well. And listen, Pittsburgh drafted defense in the first round for, what, 7 straight seasons. They were a very defense-heavy type of team. That was how they wanted to build this thing and how they were oriented, because in part they had a Hall of Fame quarterback that would just make the offense naturally look pretty good. So I think for all those factors, and probably others, is why you've not seen a receiver in the first round in so long. It's like the cornerback discussion before Artie Burns. We talked about Chad Scott before Burns came along. It's just one of those things where I don't think it's planned or intentional. It just happens sometimes. And again, like receiver, corner, premium guys go early. By the time you're picking in the mid, late first round, those names are generally off the board.
I know in the moment, back when you go back to the Artie Burns thing, it, even in the moment, it felt like a reach, and it felt like they had been instructed to better go get a height, weight, speed kind of guy. And look, generally, overall, that was viewed as a reach. Like I said, it was viewed as a reach. I mean, I remember doing a huge study on Artie Burns and his college tape, you know, ahead of that and all, you know, when they did pick him and all. I guess where I'm going with this is positional value, because there were obviously several corners off the board in that draft with Artie Burns. Do you buy into positional value in a draft more so than need?
Again, I think Pittsburgh's standpoint has always been where need and value intersect at its highest point is how they intend to draft. They don't always seem to meet that mark, Burns being one of them. Remember, that was when they wanted William Jackson the third. He goes one pick ahead, and I think they just went, okay, next corner on the board is Burns, and that's how you reach and make a decision, focusing too much on need and position as opposed to the actual value and scheme fit. But generally, Pittsburgh, it's always going to be a need. I mean, they're never truly BPA. I think most teams aren't in that bucket unless you just have an outstanding roster or just that darn committed. You have to have guys that can help you now, that can win now, contribute now, and not just sit and wait and not be able to make an impact in year one. In this day and age, it just has to happen most of the time. So again, I think Pittsburgh's philosophy under Colbert and probably still under Kahn is value and need wherever that reaches its highest, you know, point.
Okay, circling back to Mitchell, I like him. I really do. Would not hurt my feelings to see him in the black and gold. 20 does feel a little bit rich for him based only on other needs and likely positional value and all that stuff that goes into it there. Of the wide receivers that they have brought in for visits so far, and there's what, six of them now as of this morning?
Yes.
Is he the only one that you would view as a potential first round prospect?
Well, I think you'd have to maybe talk about 20 versus late first round. There is some buzz on Malachi Corley being a late first round guy to the right team, a Chiefs, for example. Pearsall's gotten more buzz recently. I think if you told me Alex, one of those six will be a first round pick, I would say it'll be Mitchell. I think he's got the strongest odds to be that first round pick. But I think Pearsall and Corley, you know, are they worth a pick at 20? That feels certainly a touch strong, even more so than Mitchell. But I think there's going to be some discussion about a late first round receiver being a Pearsall Corley in that 29 to 32 range.
All right. Now, obviously, Mike Tomlin and Omar Khan were not at that Texas Pro Day, but Zach Azani was, which makes that significance in there, which makes you kind of wonder, maybe they think there's a possibility of him. And obviously, they brought him in and all like that. So there's a reason they like him and have spent enough time researching him. Is that because maybe the potential, maybe they could trade up in the second round to go get him?
Not going to rule it out. I think trading up for a receiver is less likely than, say, a center, but we discussed the idea on Monday. And if there is a run at the position and there's a guy you really like and that position's beginning to thin out, despite how deep it is overall, it will get thin at some point, you could entertain the idea. Again, I think if the Tomlin Khan Pro Day visit rule is to be broken, and this would be the year for it to occur. I had my Pro Day recap and review up on the site this morning. They were at four Pro Days, Tomlin and Khan, which is easily the fewest combined between head coach and GM in Pittsburgh since we began tracking things in 2017, aside from the COVID year, of course, in 2020. But if they're going to break that rule, I think that guy has to come in for a visit. There's got to be some long-form, face-to-face meeting between head coach, GM, and prospect, either pro day or visit. And so for Mitchell to not have Tomlin or Khan at his pro day, I think required a visit for him to really, I think, be in play at number 20. And of course, that has happened. So long story short, I think there's enough boxes to check that you could argue that he'll be in the mix, whatever that means, at number 20.
Does this feel with the interest in him, it's more of a potential drafting situation more so than it is revisiting should he become an unrestricted free agent down the line?
I mean, I think anytime
or a trade, you know, possibility mm-hmm. or something like that later on down the line.
I think that's always a secondary aspect. I don't know if you bring in a guy necessarily just for the off chance he becomes available down the line. I think you do it with the intent of, we have interest in this guy. If he does become available in the here and now, we want to know as much as we can about him. And the down the line stuff is always a handy byproduct, but not the catalyst for why you're bringing a guy in for one of your, you know, 30 allotted visits. But yeah, I think Pittsburgh's interest in Mitchell is obviously very real.
All right. I like him. Especially when you get into that second tier of wide receivers in this year's class, you get into, in fact, where do you come in on him versus Brian Thomas?
I mean, I think they're similar guys. There's probably some work to do. I didn't do the report on Mitchell. I wrote the report on Thomas, and I was really impressed with him. Again, he's kind of a more of a one-year breakout type of guy, great ball tracking, height, weight, speed. I mean, they're similarly built overall, I think, as a blocker. Thomas gets after it. I think he's got to clean up his intermediate route running, but I think he has the tools to drop his weight and sink his hips and change directions. There might be a bit more consistency overall with Thomas than Mitchell, but they are, I think, pretty similar guys. But Pittsburgh has shown more interest in Mitchell having Azani at the Texas Pro Day. He was not at the LSU Pro Day, and to date, Thomas has not come in for a visit.
Long story short, as I like to always say, I would probably have him as my top of the second tier after the top three. I'd probably have him ranked fourth overall.
Okay, fair enough. And yeah, again, I think it's him, Thomas, his teammate Worthy, Xavier Worthy, being in that mix for that fourth receiver. I think it kind of really opens up in terms of who that guy will be once the quote-unquote big three are off the board. Dave, the switch to offensive linemen, again, Fontenot coming in sometime this week. He's got a bunch of visits lined up. Maybe that'll be later today. Maybe it'll be Thursday or Friday. Big day for Maris Mims at Georgia. He's got his individual workout. He was not healthy, had a hamstring pull to combine, could not work out at the Georgia Pro Day. So it'll be him and Brock Bowers working out. I think Jordan Reed reported that Mims will not go through the testing, the 40 and broad jump. He'll do on-field drills only. Hopefully we find out if somebody from Pittsburgh was there. Again, these things get a little less media attention, a little less access than the typical normal pro day. But given that you have two potential first-round guys in Bowers and Mims, hopefully we find out who is on hand for this workout.
Yeah, it will be interesting to see who, if we get of who might be there, because Pat Meyer was not at the Georgia Pro Day, right? Not that correct. It's not that that's a huge thing there, but because obviously he where was he that day? Do we know?
I can check our tracker. Was he out west that day? Or do we even know where he was at? Give me a second here to pull it up and see. Let's see if I can load it in for a second. I don't know. I mean, he was at what pro days did he go to? He's been out west. He's been Oregon State, and Washington this year is where we spotted him. Let me see if I can find the Georgia Pro Day. We don't know where Meyer was at on that day.
Where was he the next day?
Yeah, I'm looking around. That was March 13th, the Georgia Pro Day. Let's see, on Pat Meyer, March 11th, he was Oregon State, March 12th, Oregon. Okay, the day before, he was out west at Oregon, and we didn't spot him again until late for that Washington Pro Day in late March, so maybe there was a scheduling issue there.
Here's the thing. It was reported that Mims will come in, though, wasn't it?
Yes. We never found out the exact date on it.
Right, and, obviously, Con and Tomlin were at that pro day and all. So, there's enough of a box check there. In my opinion, you would just think that they would, you don't know how scheduling conflicts and all like that, would impact and all this, but it will in a nutshell be interesting to see if anybody shows up at his workout.
Actually, it was on March 27th, Ray Fittipaldo said that Mims had already come in for a visit. So Apparently it happened well before a couple weeks ago.
All right. Well, if he says he was in, then he was in.
Right. So again, having Tomlin and Kahn there, this happened last year with Barter Jones. Tomlin, Kahn, was Pat Meyer at the pro day for Georgia last year? Do we know?
I don't believe he was. No, if memory serves me, I don't believe he was.
Right. And so that would align with how things have looked with Mims this year. You had Tomlin Kahn at Pro Day coming in for a visit. Jones came in for a visit last year. That is certainly enough overall to tell you that he could be the pick. Now, will he be the pick? We'll see. Yeah, last year it was Tomlin Kahn, Terrell Austin, Danny Smith, Dan Rooney Jr. So to our knowledge, no Pat Meyer at that Bulldogs Pro Day last year or this year.
Okay, what about the rest of these pre-draft visitors that happened since our last show that we haven't highlighted yet. We've talked a lot about Logan Lee, especially early on in this process. I think Dane Brugler even has him listed as an edge. I so wanted him to weigh more and the tape to show more sand in the britches with him. Man, he's right in that kind of that tweener mold, and the tape is kind of hot and cold with him overall. I mean, there's some things to get excited about. There's some things I think in a run game that gets you a little bit less excited. He's going to be more to me of a day three kind of pick anyway.
Yeah. He's viewed as I think 6th round pick on mock draft database. The lack of length was the thing with me, 32.25-inch arms. Although, as I wrote about yesterday, I wonder if Pittsburgh's model with the D line is shifting a little bit because there are some of those, you know, traditional 6'4", 6'5", 300-plus pounds, 34-plus-inch arms kinds of guys, but they're getting harder to find. And, yeah, Logan Lee, it's almost like the Van Ness discussion last year, although a different scale. You know, Van Ness was a first-round pick. We're talking day three here, but rotational guy, a little bit of an edge, a little bit of an interior guy, not quite sure what he is in terms of the height, weight, and length overall. So that's a discussion there on Logan Lee, but that we're talking later, day three, if he does become Pittsburgh's pick.
All right. And what about Crumity?
Yeah, he profiles more of the traditional Steelers defensive lineman. Let me get the exact numbers on him. I think he goes 6'4", 305 with 33. What's the arm length on him?
33, I believe.
Okay. So fits a bit better. Again, we're talking day three on him as well. Jonathan Hightrader wrote the report on him about month ago and gave him a 4th round grade, day three projection, talked about, you know, run defense overall. Let me just kind of go through some of the good and the bad. Says has the base and hip bend to sit in gaps with leverage, possesses good play strength to hold his own at the point of attack, has a good long arm move coupled with a bull rush. So that's pass game, collapsing the pocket. Terms in negative, lack stop start quickness to adjust to ball carriers in the open field, can get out of control at times on his rush, will stand up on occasion when taking on double teams, leading to poor leverage, will be 24 years old. What was his stats last year? 35 tackles, 2.5 sacks, 16 quarterback hurries. Did test. I mean, he's a sporty time and his 10 split were really good. The explosion numbers, the broad and the vertical were pretty poor overall, but that's a bit more of a traditional box checker when you're talking about day three defense alignment.
Okay. And Fuaga came in, right?
No, Fontenot. We don't know the date on that. Has not happened as of Wednesday morning, but I think it'll happen sometime later this week. Yeah, Fuaga came in a couple weeks ago, but now Fontenot as well. So a lot of interest on the West Coast offensive linemen. Probably should talk about them more. We've talked about them some, but you know, I think you talk about offensive tackle. Those two are among the leaders in that clubhouse.
I think a lot of people maybe have him kick Fontenot kicking inside, don't they?
Both guys, I think, have been discussed. Fuaga doesn't have the length, and Fontenot doesn't have the height. And that's, I think, made some scouts and draftniks wonder if both or if either will kick inside to guard. But if Pittsburgh's showing interest, I assume that's to stay a tackle because they don't have any desire to kick either one of those guys inside the guard.
Right. It wouldn't feel like it, but I mean, at least there's enough interest in him, you know, to bring him in. So who else are we missing that came in?
Well, Max Melton was officially in on Monday.
We talked good about him.
Yeah, we talked about him. And I think that's been the list so far. Again, typically these are getting released later around noontime each day. Couple of visits coming in. Let me just double check here. But it was Lee and Melton on Monday, and then Mitchell and Crumity on Tuesday. I believe that's the list this week.
All right. And the list is very, very heavy, as we've reviewed several times, on tackles, wide receivers, and corners.
Yeah. So we are up to 23 known or reported visits that do not include the local names. So we are marching ever so closer to the 30. Hopefully we get there by next week.
Well, hopefully we get there by really today and tomorrow, right? Because what's the likelihood of bringing in somebody on Friday?
Yeah, they could. I mean, I know I said previously that typically this is the last week for visits. There may be a couple next week. I think there's some prospect for some team, not with Pittsburgh, coming in for a visit next week. So you may get a couple final ones Monday, Tuesday, but we'll come back on Friday and see where things are at.
Okay. What else do we have to talk about here before we, because Dane Brugler released his annual, very comprehensive, draft guide, which is always a great read. If you know, you have to go to The Athletic, to get it, be a subscriber to it. But you know, if there's one thing that The Athletic, has as a draw and a feature, it's definitely his draft guide. It's definitely a great read. I think Dane does a great job of not only talking about strengths and weaknesses of players. He does very good detailed backgrounds on the players. He talks, you know, he also always lists in there, you know, games played, games started, you know, if they missed due to injury time and all like that. So it's a great at a glance to learn a lot more, go deeper into players, especially stuff that would take a lot of research on the internet to find stuff as far as background kind of stuff on these players here. So before we roll down a couple position groups, when it comes to that draft guide, what else do we have to cover here?
Yeah, let's put a bow on a couple of more housekeeping type things. We now know officially Pittsburgh will not play in Brazil week one against the Philadelphia Eagles on that Friday night game. That was a possibility based on Pittsburgh playing as the away team against Philadelphia this year, but it'll officially be the Green Bay Packers, which was kind of reported and made mention of yesterday and then officially announced by Adam Schefter today. And so we don't know when Pittsburgh will play Philadelphia in Philly, but it will not be week one, and Pittsburgh will be staying domestically in the USA in 2024.
Yeah, we kind of speculated that would wind up being the case with them this year. I would really look for this team to have an international game next year, whether it be Ireland or Mexico. That just feels right. So no international game for the Steelers this year.
All right. And then the contract on Michael Pruitt is in. You can explain that and give us a cap update, Dave.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, this ended up being a veteran benefit contract with him. We kind of figured that might be the case. I think the most interesting thing here is he did not get a signing bonus here. He does have a $50,000 roster bonus that he can earn, and I assume that's if he makes the initial 53-man roster overall here. So with this being a veteran benefit contract and with there being a $50,000 roster bonus potentially attached to it, it puts his cap number at $1.035 million. So once again, no guaranteed money tied to this. Is this a huge shock that they did not give him any type of signing bonus? No, I don't think so at its core. I mean, this is a guy that's, you know, up there in age, a guy that I thought the tape was a little bit more inconsistent on the blocking than maybe you did. He does have some special teams value, but it is kind of limited, it feels like, to kickoff return nature here. So, look, he's going to – he do not write his name down in pen when it comes to the 53-man roster. I think that's what the contract says. I think that's what the tape says. I think everything about him, that's what it screams when it comes to this. But once again, as I always say every offseason here, give me as many veteran benefit contract guys with experience that you can give me, and I will sort through them in camp. And that is the case with him. So not a lot of anything really invested in him. It feels like you can cut him with no salary cap repercussions whatsoever. He will have to earn himself a roster spot.
I know the sample size would be small, but I'd be really interested in seeing in Pittsburgh, you know, how many players on the veteran, what's it called? Veteran salary benefit, veteran minimum benefit. What is the exact phrasing? I always get that.
Veteran benefit contract.
Veteran benefit contract. How many of them made the roster when they received the maximum signing bonus versus any signing bonus that was not the maximum versus a zero, you know, no signing bonus? I'd be curious to know what the likelihood of somebody making the roster in Pittsburgh is at kind of each of those levels.
Well, years ago, it used to be stronger, I think, that those guys that did receive those veteran benefit contracts make the roster. But then you get into the Nile Davis year, because for a while, remember, it was like Kevin Barlow
was the only one who didn't make the team.
What was the guy? But it seems like they're more apt to move on. I mean, look, just last year, who was the tackle?
Sittler Avon Clark.
Yeah, I mean, he didn't make it. I mean, you're seeing more instances of that now, where these guys, even veteran benefit contracts with the max signing bonus allowed for those things. Which last year, what was it? 152,500, something like that. You're seeing more of these guys these days. In other words, it's not stamp them. It's not write them their name down in pen if they sign a veteran benefit contract with any kind of signing bonus attached. Don't write them down in pen of making a 53-man roster.
Sure, but I wonder, is there a difference between the guy who gets the maximum signing bonus and the guy who gets zero signing bonus? Or are their odds of making the roster roughly the same because in the grand scheme of the cap, the money is negligible?
Yeah, I mean, I'd have to go back and redo that study. I can't even remember it's been several years since I did such a study. Basically, the study was, I think, of guys that they signed during the any free agent signed during the compensatory signing period. I think that's how it's been so many years ago, Alex, since I'd done that. Mm-hmm. But I think the study was what was the percentage of guys signed during, you know, prior to the draft and free agency of whether or not those guys made the roster.
Right. I'd just be curious to see if the data has changed at all and if the money has an impact. But obviously, yeah, I mean, Pruitt's spot, we know, regardless of what signing bonus he did or did not get, is not guaranteed. Although I do think they carry four tight ends. There's kind of a thing that Arthur Smith does. And so if you carry four, you got Freiermuth, you got Washington. Let's assume Hayward makes it. You got a fourth spot there between him and Rodney Williams. It's up for grabs, but, you know, would not be surprised to see Pruitt, the Arthur Smith type, the better blocker than Rodney Williams, although not as strong on special teams. But, you know, that's certainly a spot there for Michael Pruitt.
Look, could he end up making a 53? Yes. But I'm not, what I'm getting at is I'm not writing him down in pen.
Sure. I don't think anybody is, just based on the age, based on lack of production, based on Pittsburgh's tight end room. Where does Pittsburgh stand cap wise? And I know you had noted that Pittsburgh is currently projection, but based on future costs, they're over the cap, but explain why that's not really a concern.
Yeah, and it's the same discussion that we usually have about these things. Let me pull up that page real quick here. As of the signing of Pruitt, this team now is 12.0, almost 12.076 under the cap. The league still has not put in the projected CBA mandated workout bonus placeholder charge of $907,200. Obviously, you have the rookie pool offset coming with the draft picks. That's going to be probably somewhere in the neighborhood of $3.5 million to $4 million, depending on if they move up or down or what have you there. So there's $3.5 million. You've got the 51st or 52nd and 53rd player you have to account for, which is almost $1.6 million. You got a full practice squad, which will eat up around $4 million. And then you get into estimated stuff that everybody takes issue with that I do every year. I have, because you don't know what's going to happen with guys that might have to start the season on IR. And if they do, you have to accommodate players on the 53-man roster taking up those guys' spots. I put in a placeholder of $2 million in case that list is larger than or is significant. And then also the end season, how much money will they want, or how much cap space will they want free to start the season with, to have in reserves? A couple of years ago, they went into the season with $9 million. So last year I had that buffer is $9 million. They ended up going into the season with right around $6 million. last season in buffer space. So this year I have it as $6 million. I think Omar Khan last year, or it, one of the press conferences said around $5 million. So at least I would count on $5 million being the buffer at a minimum that this team will want in free cap space. As I just mentioned there, I have projected at $6 million this year, another $2 million in accommodating whatever injured reserve happens there. So those are kind of more negotiable aspects there. If you go off of my projections of what's forthcoming in future salary cap expenses, that would currently have the team at a projected estimated 6.2 over the cap. You obviously have the ability to, you know, what's going to happen with Cam Hayward? Are you going to free up around $9 million with an extension with him? Alex Highsmith, you can restructure that contract and free up $7.2 million in salary cap space. So, once again, when you look at this, you have to look at this at lines in the sand, line down the road, and all like that. The fact that they have nearly 12.076 million in salary cap space is more than enough to do what they need to do from here on through the draft. And really, that includes signing their draft picks and all the stuff that comes along with that. I do, however, think for the most part, that we have seen the significant signings, free agent signings happening. Now, could they go out and get another center or a wide receiver for more than the minimum? Yes. Will it be a significant average yearly value contract? Probably not. Could it be more than the minimum? Absolutely. But I think the main meat of what they wanted to do during the offseason here has been chewed up at this point.
Yeah, I think that's fair overall. But you would just say, and you've been consistent about this, but just to say it explicitly, Pittsburgh is in a fine place cap-wise, correct?
I have learned over the years that all teams are always in a fine cap space.
But compared to the Saints in terms of the can kicking, I mean, but point is, I mean, they can do whatever they need to do. They're not in a situation where they feel like they can't do something if they, some opportunity were to arise.
Right. When you have the ability to do things, you know, and we'll see what happens with Cam Hayward, and you know, you have Alex Highsmith, I view as the primest candidate to have an extension at some point. I mean, a restructure at some point during the offseason because he has the freshest contract. After him, it would probably be Minka. I will be surprised if they get to the point where they have to restructure Minka and Alex Highsmith, but at least the availability to do that is at least out there. And then, you know, once again, we'll see what happens with Cam Hayward. And then obviously, look, we did not put this in projected future salary cap expenses this offseason, but what's going to happen with Pat Freiermuth? Are they going to sign him to a contract extension? If they do, his cap charge will increase some, not significantly, but some. So that needs to be accounted for as well, too. So, yes, they are in for what it feels like they have to do the rest of the way through the draft, and really even a month or two after the draft, you know, that they have more, you know, barring going out there and trading for an Ayuk or look, you will see signs that something big might happen at this point, because if they were to trade for an Ayuk right now, they would not be able to accommodate his initial cap number before an extension. So you would have to, something would happen. We would see a shift in cap space, i.e. either an extension for Cam Hayward or a restructure with Alex Highsmith. There will be a quick sign here in the next couple of weeks if they were to going to go out and add someone like Brandon Ayuk via a trade, because they just simply could not accommodate his initial cap number right now without doing so. Now, obviously, you could lower his cap number after getting him in the building via an extension, but to get him in the building, they would need more cap space right now,
which is actually pretty useful. So we'll kind of get a little bit of a sign before, you know, if any trade were to happen, which we won't spend any more time on, who knows if it'll happen or not, not looking super likely, but there'll be some signs before there's no way that deal could just pop up out of nowhere. Probably you would hear some sort of contract movement before the Adam Schefter or Ian Rapoport tweet took place.
Right. Now look, sometimes restructures filter out 24, 48, 72 hours after they actually happen, you know, because again, the NFLPA public salary cap report does not happen in real time, you know. Mm-hmm. So you're usually at a delay by a couple of days when anything happens with a player's contract, unless it does get leaked and reported by an insider or something like that. But I will be letting the world know if there's all of a sudden a shift in cap space for this team in the next couple of weeks.
Gotcha. So good update from you there, Dave, and appreciate all the updates throughout the very busy offseason. I'm trying to balance things and explain where Pittsburgh is at cap-wise. All right. Anything else we need to get to before we kind of dive into what they call the Beast, Dane Brugler's big mega draft guide?
Yeah, and it's things nobody wants to talk about, but I want to talk about it, so damn it, I'm going to talk about it. It's the cash expenditure. I put a post up on Steelers Depot yesterday reviewing what all the Steelers have done from February 2nd to April 9th. And why is February 2nd significant? Because that was really technically the day that they finished signing their players to the reserve future contracts, of getting their 2024 roster at least to 53 players. It went well beyond that, obviously, with all the future deals that they had, but it gave us a solid starting point to look at the top 53 cash, not cap, cost of the team on February 2nd. Now, obviously, a lot of stuff has happened since February 2nd. They have reshaped this roster quite significantly. But on February 2nd, the top 53 cash cost on this team totaled out at a little over $195.5 million. And then, boy, did we start seeing some cash cutting going on. And in fact, they cut, if you look at what all happened, you know, they traded away Deontay Johnson, they cut Allen Robinson, they cut Chukwuma Okorafor, they cut Patrick Peterson, they cut Mitch Trubisky, they cut Mason Cole, they cut Keanu Neal, they traded Kenny Pickett, and they cut Presley Harvin. If you look at those nine players overall, the total cash, the initial cash saved just by the jettisoning of those players was almost $50.9 million in cash that was set to go towards those players in 2024. That's 26% of that initial top 53 cash cost that this team had on February 2nd. Now, it's been fun to watch how they've, you know, rebuilt this roster and even added more players with roughly about the same amount of really total cash. Because if you look at all the players and discounts, not only outside free agents, but a few of their own free agents being re-signed, such as Montrevious Adams, Miles Killebrew, who else was re-signed? Christian Kuntz. Even you can add Braden Fajoco on that list, because that's happened since February 2nd as well, too. When you add up the cost of those 16 players who weren't on the 2024 roster on February 2nd, that totals out to $50.8 million. So really just a difference of almost $33,000 there. And you add more players in. So it's been interesting to watch what they've done in reshaping this roster from a cash perspective from February 2nd to April 9th. In fact, they have actually saved, because of the matriculation in the top 53, because of offset and all like that, they've actually saved almost $6.5 million in actual cash in that top 53 versus February 2nd to April 9th. I got to admit, now look, I have not tracked this stuff religiously over the years. This is a new hot button for me, because I want to learn predictive measures when it comes to this. I would, if you would have told me that this team on February 2nd to April 9th that they actually, their cash expenditure total would have went down $6 million. I probably wouldn't have believed you. I would have had to seen that drawn out. But that's that's what has happened here. Now, look, are they done spending cash this year? No. You still have to accommodate your entire draft class. That includes undrafted free agents. You still have a practice squad that you have to accommodate. You have obviously other things, you know, Pat Freiermuth extension may or may not happen. You've got a good $20 million already tabbed on your rookie class, on your practice squad, on your off-season workout bonuses and all like that. So that's another $20 million to be spent. But look, if you go at where I projected this team to spend, which is 92% of the cap number in cash, which is a total of $235 million. And even if you go ahead and project a Pat Freiermuth extension down the road, that leaves still really another $13 million in cash that you kind of wonder where that will get spent overall. And we talked recently, I think just as last show or two shows ago, whenever, might we see a Najee Harris and or Jaylen Warren contract extension at some point this offseason in addition to a Pat Freiermuth? And I don't, long story short, I don't think you can rule that out unless there is another big cash expenditure coming up or two with a free agent wide receiver, a center, something along those lines there. Or is this team just not going to spend 92% of the league's cap number in cash, which is another plausible, because this is the first of 3 years. You could always make it up in year two and year three there. But there is some uncertainty here as far as, A, how much more cash will this team spend this offseason? And B, if they do spend at least 92% of the cap number in cash, where's that other $13 million going to go to?
It's a fair question. And if they didn't spend it, if that becomes the reality, just hypothetically, then that would mean that next year and year after would be pretty aggressive. It would have to be, correct?
Correct. Because you have to spend at least 90% of a three-year cap total period in cash in a three-year span. And I think the Steelers usually try to be at 100% of cap in cash spent in that three-year span, at least what we're working off of from the previous 3 years here. Why do I do this? A, you know, I'm getting into this because my next project is to go back the last couple of years, and it's going to take a lot of work to do it, to find out if there's any kind of trend from, let's say, once the initial 53 is built out with future contracts up until, say, 2 weeks before free agency start, before the draft happens, because that's when the bulk of your free agency work is done. If there is a pattern here of them kind of tit for tat, out the door goes the cash, and really almost one for one in cash dollars being replaced to rebuild this team. Now, obviously, there's probably going to be some variances in there because the cap going up and all like that. But I want to see if, you know, how closely, in other words, is there a predictive measure in this down the line to say, all right, they sent, let's say, $60 million out the door. I would kind of expect them to spend $60 to $70 million, at least in cash, in free agency or trades, in replacing that.
Yeah, again, as you said, there's hopefully some predictive power to it, is the whole point of why you're going down these rabbit holes and exploring these topics and having these discussions. Let me just send you down maybe one other smaller rabbit hole. We discussed recently some rough framework of what a Najee Harris extension could look like, and that's plausible. I think it's a conversation that'll come up more in the summer after they, and assuming that they pick up his fifth-year option in less than 1 month, but What does a Jaylen Warren extension look like based on that Pittsburgh has some kind of control over him and he's been, you know, a timeshare kind of guy, not been the lead guy in a messy running back market? I have no idea where to even begin with Jaylen Warren.
Yeah, and I think because he's trapped has a lot to do with it here with him. But could you get him in a situation where, you know, at least
$5 million per year?
Nah, that feels rich. Yeah, it feels rich.
But he's got to have some incentive to do this deal. Otherwise, he could just play out his contract and get his payday.
Sure, but I mean, he also wants, you know, he probably also would like the cash in his pocket now as opposed to the IFCOM here on top of it. I mean, it feels like, and this is dangerous because I have not worked out, I have not put the numbers in a spreadsheet or anything like that. But, you know, could you get him to an average yearly value of, I don't know, where really Najee's at now, which is about $3 million or so?
Just feels too light from him. You get one bite at this apple for a running back on a contract extension, and to take that three, it just feels really light.
Yeah, but the Steelers will say, look, okay, you know, make your 800 and something, you know, whatever you schedule to make 800 something thousand this year. And we will put a second round tender on you next year if you stay healthy and productive and do everything needed to do. And good luck in getting there. And basically, you have a chance to earn X amount of dollars these next 2 years, and you're capped at that, whether you like it or not. And
sure.
And
but those tenders are getting expensive. They aren't as cheap as they used to be.
Sure, but you know, once again, you have real quick here, the second round. Okay, well, the second round tender this year for RFAs was 4.89.
Right.
So once again, 4.89, and what did we say his base salary is this year?
830. Is that what you just said?
Hold on here. 985.
Okay.
So I mean, again, a million plus, let's say 5 million. That's 6 million when adding those two together over the course of the next 2 years. You know, now his average yearly value is not going to be I wouldn't think going to be 6 million. I think he the best shot is to be half of that there. But the thing is, he's getting that money. You know, a good half of that money now this year, you know, in form of signing bonus. And look, the Steelers aren't in the business of giving gifts away, especially when they got guys trapped like this.
Sure. But they have a decision next year after this year as an RFA, because where do you come in on the tender? That'll be actually a pretty interesting discussion, because, again, these tenders are not getting cheaper.
Right. You put the tender on them and you try to work out a deal with them from there.
Yeah, but which tender? The original round tender? A higher level tender?
No. I mean, yeah, if you put a right of first refusal on him, he's gone.
No, I understand. So there's going to be a cost on the tender, because if you're not doing the original round tender, it's going to cost you, I don't know, at least $3-4 million, if not more.
No. I mean, the projected right now RFA tender on a second round tender is $4.97 million. So. They're, you know, it's either right of first refusal, second round, or first round tender. They're not going to put a first round tender on you.
No, I know. But that's my point. If you're Warren saying you're going to give me $3 million per year, I'll play out this year, force you guys to put a $5 million tender on me next year.
And the Steelers, okay, that's all right. That's the way you want it. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. But I mean, there's a little risk for Pittsburgh there as well. Because they can't that 5 year, that $5 million tender is on that 1 year. They can't spread that out the way they could over a long term deal that was worth, say, $5 million per year.
But they'll budget for that. They'll be fine with that. Then they'll go to them after putting that tender on and say, do you want to do a deal or not?
Yeah, I just think it's a little interesting to kind of see how that one will play out.
With the cap escalating and all like that, if that's the worst problem that this team has right now, is putting a second round tender on Jaylen Warren next year before the before free agency starts. I mean that's a first world problem right there.
It is. But my point is, when I said $5 million per year, if you put a second round tender on him next year, you're saying he's worth $5 million per year. So on an extension, why would you not get at least $5 million per year? Just the way the franchise tag, if you tag him, you're saying he's worth the tag number, and that's kind of the floor in terms of what a long term deal looks like.
Yeah, but they're not going to give him. They're not going to gladly give him the cheeseburger today. You know, the old Popeye saying there, but. They want it. They'll probably gladly do a deal with him this offseason, but the deal's going to be on their terms.
I get that, but it can't be that far off from $5 million. I mean, Warren and his agent understands the situation he could be in next year, and he doesn't want to take significantly less than that.
Sure, but he's also capped with what he can earn.
No, I get that. I just think it just be interesting to kind of see where the number comes in. I think Najee's a bit clearer in terms of what that market value is based on kind of what happened this year with Barkley. We talked about him probably coming right under some of those top running back deals. I think Warren gets a little bit trickier for a bunch of reasons.
You are a lot more stressed about Warren's situation than I envisioned you being here.
But, I'm not stressed. I'm just wondering what his market value is. I think it's kind of interesting to talk about what he'd be willing to take, what the team be willing to offer, what the market says.
I think that if you were to go ahead and map out, okay, let's say $5 million next year on a second round tender, and let's say round up to $1 million he's going to earn this year. That's a max he can earn of $6 million over the course of the next 2 years. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you got him at 3.8 million average yearly value with roughly 3.8 million in cash paid to him this year, that's a deal that would be very hard for him to turn down.
What do you think? How many years on that deal do you think? Two, three?
I think you would do it with, if you got a deal done with him now, it would mm-hmm. be this year plus two more years, I would envision.
Okay. So we're looking at 3 years. What would the overall structure be? 3 years, 3.8? Is that what you would say? 3 years, 11 to 11 and a half?
I would let's map it out at 3 times 3.8.
Okay, that's 11.4.
You know, that's livable. That would make his cap hit would still be very manageable this year.
Mm-hmm.
The cash expenditure fits. You know, everything about it. The second year cap hit would be okay versus what you would expect the cap to go up and all like that. So. You know, it can be done, but once again, the Steelers aren't going to set any type of a huge precedent too with RFAs getting huge, you know, winning the war, so to speak.
Sure. No, I get that. But let's say it doesn't happen this year. If you go into a contract for next year, if you tend to him and try to work out a long-term deal, then maybe it is going to cost a bit more because you've placed the value on him with the tender.
Right. But you also have the cap going up and all like that. It's all, it's all exponential, you know, when it comes to that. Yeah. I mean, once you put a second round tender on him of, let's say it's 4.978, you're telling him you are worth 4.978 to us mm-hmm. this year.
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, we'll see. I mean, I think Harris is more likely to get something done than Warren. I'm not positive. You know,
here's
Harris
the thing. Would even get the extension. You're not going to do Warren and then not do Najee, because you will right. have, once again, you'll have a pissed off Najee if you do that.
Yeah, no, for sure. So again, I think Harris becomes priority of any long term deal. Warren is more secondary. If that happens, maybe that happens in camp or something like that.
If Najee does not get done, it's hard to imagine Warren getting done as well. Agreed. Too. It feels like it's either one, Najee gets done, or both get done.
That makes sense. And you mentioned Freiermuth as well. And I'll even mention, although I know from a cash standpoint, it may not change things significantly, but James Daniels, what happens with him last year of his contract, starting guard, does he get an extension look this offseason?
It could fit based on, and once again, they're just projections on my part, you know, as far as cash expenditures go. You know, could you feasibly get something done with him? Yes.
With Daniels?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. Although the guard market really heated up. So, I mean, it's a time where I'm sure Daniels' agents wanting to cash in, because the guard market went insane this year with some big, big money, Kevin Dotson, et cetera. So, that would take a heavy cost to get a deal done with him.
How old is he?
He's pretty young still. He's 26, 27.
Yeah. I mean, if you were going to do it, and if you had confidence that he could be that guy for you for the next, you know, at least 3 years, counting this year, yeah. You know, and he's not wanting to be the top five guard paid in the NFL, you know.
Yeah, again, I haven't worked out what that number would be, but just something on the horizon, something else to consider. That's not really been talked about too much. It's been a lot of Freiermuth discussion, just generally from, you know, Pittsburgh media. But I think Daniels is one name where it's a possibility as well.
Sure.
I'm reading here just some text, and we'll have to probably talk about it more on Friday show, and I know that he's not everyone's favorite, but Jason Lucanfora on a podcast saying the Steelers are really, they're trying to make something happen to add another receiver before the draft via a trade. So for whatever that's worth, Lucanfora is going to fan the flames of a receiver trade.
Okay, well, once again, if that player that you're trading for has a base salary greater than what they have in cap space right now that you have to first accommodate, then something will happen as far as a restructure goes. Could they possibly be trading for somebody that maybe has a year left in addition to this year on their contract? That's possible as well, too. I mean, who would that guy be, you know?
Yeah, I have not looked at the list.
Not named Ayuk, you know.
Sure. And again, I mean, you could sit there and say, just go draft a receiver. It's a really good class. Instead of having to trade for somebody, pay them, older, et cetera. And again, I know that he's not always been the most reliable person in the entire world, but says he would not be surprised to see it happen at any point before the draft, including while Pittsburgh is on the clock. Also thinks it would not shock him if they took a corner in the first round over offensive line. So whatever that's worth, the grains of salt, et cetera, that is Lucanfora's standpoint.
All right.
Also, pre-draft visitors coming in. And hello, a center has come in for a visit, Dave. Jackson Powers Johnson in for a visit today. And so you can check that box, been waiting for the center to come in. Also, Blake Fisher from Notre Dame, the right tackle, more mid-round guy. I compared him to Dan Moore, wrote the report on Blake Fisher. And so he's played a right tackle. Pittsburgh looking for a right tackle. That makes sense. But Jackson Powers Johnson officially in for a pre-draft visit.
All right. Well, at least that checks that box. And then you could use the crutch of he's out west. That's why Tomlin and Khan did not go to that pro day, yada, yada. You know, so he's there's enough boxes in a need check there where you could plausibly think that there's a possibility that Jackson Powers Johnson could be picked 20th overall. However, there's been a lot of discussion about will Powers Johnson fall out of the first round, that kind of stuff as well, too.
Yeah, and I think in Dane Brugler's, it's a good segue time here into Dane Brugler's The Beast Media Guide. He mentioned some injury concerns with Powers Johnson. Let me pull up the exact text that he notes here. If I can get this thing to load, it's such a massive file. It's going to take a few seconds to actually load in the information. On Powers Johnson, says the medicals will be important after he battled multiple injuries, including groin and hip issues in 2023, along with multiple concussions over his career. And so that's a little note there from Dane Brugler, stuff that we don't always kind of get publicly or mentioned too much. And so that's notable on Jackson Powers Johnson. One reason maybe why he could fall.
He's got him as a first to second round grade. You know, why don't we just dive into the center position here when it comes to Dane Brugler's draft guide. He's got Graham Barton listed as his top center out of Duke. He firmly has a first round grade on him. Beyond that, you get into second. He's got Jackson Powers Johnson, first to second round grade. And then he goes into Zach Frazier as a firmly second round grade on him. The order of that, probably not huge. You know, it depends on where you come down on Graham Barton position, you know, not really being a true center versus Jackson Powers Johnson being more of a true center of who you want one or two. But those it's hard to argue overall with the top three rankings there. After that, he's got Tanner Bordellini out of Wisconsin as his fourth center, who he has a third to fourth round grade on. Cedric Van Pran Granger out of Georgia, third, fourth round grade on. And then it starts getting really, really messy from there. Bo Limmer, Hunter Norzad out of Penn State, Kingsley, Egukin out of Florida, fifth or sixth round. Your boy Matt Lee out of Miami, fifth or sixth round grade. And if you get that far down the list, at that point, you missed a boat there. So, you know, do you like Graham Barton or Jackson Powers Johnson? Does the team like Graham Barton, Jackson Powers Johnson enough to make them to pick make either one of them to pick at 20th overall? It feels like a huge long shot that either one of those two would fall to you at in the second round with their pick. Now, could both of them potentially maybe fall into the top of the second round and then you go get either one? That's probably plausible. I tell you, the most interesting discussion from here on out would be, is Zach Frazier going to be on the board for you at 51 overall?
Sure. And that's certainly possible. I mean, I've been beating that drum even early in the pre-draft process when people said, oh, there's no way he's going to, you know, be an inkling of him falling that far and centers do fall. But you roll the dice. It's a coin flip. He could go at 50 and you're totally screwed. And he might fall, quote unquote, even if he goes to the 50, as I mentioned on a previous podcast, and he's not there. And that's all that ultimately matters. I think if somebody has a higher chance to at least fall lower than projections, it would be Paris Johnson. I don't think Barton even makes it into round two. I think Paris Johnson could. Been watching more of him lately, Paris Johnson. I mean, he's strong, he's torquey, he's nasty. I don't think he's actually a terrible athlete. I want to maybe retract something I had said a little while back. I don't think he's a bad athlete, but I think he does struggle to redirect and hit targets in space and sustain blocks when he has to kind of move laterally. So there's a bit of a difference there. I think out in screens, he's got enough foot speed to get there, to be a lead blocker. But I think he does struggle being able to hit a moving target, you know, climbing to the second level on zone blocks, or combo blocks, and that could be an issue in Pittsburgh.
Okay. All right.
So he's got Barton, Paris Johnson, Frazier as the top three. And yeah, and then Borellini, who had a fantastic workout. I did not love his tape. I really kind of a guy that I'm mixed on because the testing was off the charts good, but I thought the tape was really poor. And then Van Pran Granger has been talked about quite a bit, but I think Brugler had said a while back, the NFL not as high on him as draft picks were back in January, February.
True or false? Grant, one of Graham Barton, Jackson Powers Johnson, or Zach Frazier will be a Pittsburgh Steeler.
Yeah, it's a, you can't ask me this one right now. It's like the day before the draft type of question.
Oh man, I'm true. I don't take me half a second to think true on that.
I mean, I think so. I'll go with you on true, but when and how and where and all the particulars, I'm not sure how it's gonna play out.
I do not think, though, that you will get, once again, I would be surprised if you got Barton or Powers Johnson at 51 overall. It feels like you would have to take them at one of them at 20 or go up maybe into the second round early to get one of the two should they fall out of the first round. I think I've been kind of, you know, hedging this way for a while. I think that there's a possibility that Frazier might be on the board at 51.
Yeah, I mean, I've routinely had him at 51 in my mock drafts. I think it's possible. It's just, there's, again, it's 50-50 to me if he's there or not. And if you're Pittsburgh, if you don't take center in the first round, do you want to roll that dice? I think if you're Pittsburgh, if those guys are gone, Barton, Paris Johnson, you take a tackle in round one, receiver, whatever, you got to really consider making a trade up for Frazier in round two.
All right, with center out of the way, let's look at some tackles here on Dane Brugler's draft guide here as far as his rankings go. He's got Joe Alt, first overall, Olu Fashanu out of Penn State, another first-round graded guy, J.C. Latham out of Alabama. Have we given enough respect to J.C. Latham? And we've talked about him quite a bit. Obviously, the Steelers at the pro day and all. To date, though, he has not been brought in for a visit, though, correct?
Correct. Yeah. No, not brought in for a visit. We've discussed him some. The conventional wisdom is he'll be gone before 20, but I certainly do not believe that's ironclad. So we should discuss that possibility.
It is a possibility. Do you feel though that he might be off the board?
Again, I think the conventional wisdom throughout the draft process has had him off the board before 20, but again, in a deep tackle class where the quarterbacks will push some people down, receivers will push some people down. We'll see if a couple of corners go. There'll be a couple of edge rushers, Dallas Turner, Latu from UCLA, et cetera. It's, you know, 20% chance, whatever the odds are, but there's a chance.
All right. Number four on his list is Talese Fuaga out of Oregon State, firmly a first round draft pick in Brugler's mind. There, I think the most notable thing when it comes to him is the arm length and the age, really. The age isn't a huge red flag at 22.06. Arm length, 33 and an eighth.
You know what I think is really interesting? He's got Fuaga as a tackle and Trey Fontenot as his top-rated guard. He's not even put Fontenot in the guard category, despite being longer than Fuaga.
Well, I talk about Fontenot and that size.
Sure, sure. But I mean, Pat Meyer likes length. And Fuaga does not have it. He's right on kind of that traditional 33-inch arm benchmark. He's what, 33 and a quarter, right around there? 33 and an eighth, so right there. But he has played tackle. Just interesting to see. I mean, I wonder, is this when he has Fuaga at tackle, Fontenot at guard, is that from what he's hearing from scouts, his own personal evaluation? He does say with Fontenot he could be a five position player, could even play center. He floats out the idea of that. So he's not saying that Fontenot must go to guard, but he does put Fontenot in that guard bucket.
As connected as Brugler has been over the years, I feel like he, you know, he gets some things that obviously a lot of us don't get. In other words, that scout, and plus he waits so long. I mean, he got 2 weeks now until the draft. So he makes sure he probably tries to cross as many T's and dot as many I's as he possibly can. So the fact that he has him listed as a guard, I think he's probably heard from a collective probably of NFL, you know, GMs, you know, personnel, scouts, whatever, that a lot of people probably consider him as a guard.
Sure. And I think that's certainly notable and why I wanted to make mention of it. But obviously Pittsburgh has the interest they have, you know, if they view him as a tackle, then what the NFL views,
sure,
you know, the other 31 teams doesn't matter. But that is, I think, notable. But yeah, to go back to tackle, he's got what, Mims fifth, I think, on his list?
Mims fifth and the last one that he has a solid first round grade on.
Okay. So again, Mims will work out today. I think will be important for him. We'll see if Pittsburgh's there. I wonder, you know, what if Waga, Mims, Fontenot are all there? What does Pittsburgh do if those are the options?
It feels like Mims. I went and watched a little bit more of his tape last night, the Ohio State game, and that just feels like something they would not pass up.
Yeah, I've really gone back and forth. I was kind of with you on Mims, and I'm beginning to second guess myself. I don't know where I'll come in on, and you guys will see that for my final mock draft and final thoughts in less than 2 weeks.
What other position here do we want to talk about with Brugler? We talked really about wide receiver already.
Yeah, I think he's got A.D. Mitchell. Was his fifth or sixth best receiver? I'm trying to scroll through the giant spreadsheet, that the PDF file here. What does he have Mitchell at? Let me read off his top receivers. It goes Marvin Harrison Jr. 1, Malik Nabers 2, Rome Odunze 3, Brian Thomas 4. And so again, after the top three, where do things kind of open up? He's got Thomas 4 as a first round grade, and then Ladd McConkey from Georgia, number 5, A.D. Mitchell 6, Keon Coleman 7, Roman Wilson 8, Ricky Pearsall 9, Xavier Worthy at 10 with a second to third round grade on him.
Okay. Go ahead.
What about corner? Any other thoughts on receiver? I was going to push you to cornerback and kind of see what he has.
I was going
to
go. I have defensive tackles pulled up next. Okay. So he's got Byron Murphy out of Texas ranked first. The only one with a first round grade. Then he's got Johnny Newton, who's causing a lot of discussion as of late out of Illinois with a first to second round grade because of his really lack of overall length. You know, I would think that the Steelers are not going to be in the discussion of Johnny Newton. Chris Jenkins, he has third as a second round grade. Once again, it kind of feels like the Steelers might go another direction other than him. Now you get into Rook Ohorohora out of Clemson. We've talked quite a bit about, you would think would be in the Steelers' sights. He's got him ranked fourth overall as a second to third round grade. Mike Hall Jr. out of Ohio State, he has fifth. And then Mason Smith out of LSU, he has sixth with a second to third round grade. The two guys, and then he's got Fisk at seventh overall out of Florida State, a guy that we've talked about that lacks, you know, the arm length there is the big, the tape's fantastic. The measurable, you know, when you look at the arm length, kind of a concern there overall there. Of those top seven guys, once you get past those guys, I mean, we've had discussions about Gabe Hall. Who else have we had discussions about? I mean, they brought in Crumity, but that, that you're getting into later round guys. Mm-hmm. We've talked about Christian Boyd out of Northern Iowa as a late round fallback option there. Who else on this list later on? I mean, it feels like those are the guys that the Steelers are looking at. Overall, they've obviously brought in, a few of these guys. To me, the guys that screen potential Steelers are Ahura Ahura, Mason Smith, possibly Fisk. And then if you had to wait until later rounds, a Gabe Hall, man, Crumity. I suppose you got to add him to the list. And then Christian Boyd much later in this draft.
Yeah.
And then I guess Logan Lee, but I mean, what do they view him as? You know, and plus he would be a late round guy after the fact anyway.
Mm-hmm. I think Brugler has him as a D end in his PDF here, his draft book. So yeah, you mentioned the names, Dave. I mean, they've Darius Robinson too. We should mention him. He's that tweener type from Missouri. I think also Brugler has him as a defensive end, but he came in for a visit. I mean, the tea leaves tell you they're going to draft an end. The question is just who that guy is, and will Pittsburgh make a compromise on the lack of length? I think they still want guys who are 6'4", 300 pounds, at least have the framework to add a little bit of weight. But when you bring in Logan Lee and show interest in Fisk, and those guys aren't checking the length box, has that compromise been made there? Fisk would be a lot of outliers. He's 24. He has severely, poor length, not super tall overall, but obviously there's interest there.
Right. And the tape's not bad either.
Yeah, no, he's productive for sure. So we'll see. But I do think D-line will happen sometime. I really think ideally, if you could, maybe not ideally, but Mason Smith, you get him with that first third round pick at 84, right. Have him play 15 snaps per game as a rookie, rotate in a little bit, develop, and then replace, maybe Ogunjobi after 2024 for 2025 as kind of the best case scenario of how you might try to play this thing.
Yeah, and we've talked about this several times. It feels like one of Ahura Ahura or Mason Smith will wind up being Steelers if things go break the way in their favor.
Right. I think those are two distinct possibilities. But Ahura Ahura, will he be there at 84 is the question. Do you have to take him at 51?
Yeah, it feels like you probably would have to take him at 51. Yes.
That's
or trade up somewhere, should he fall past that?
Right. So that makes that one a little more complicated. What does he have at corner? We're running pretty long here. I'll just kind of go through corner very briefly overall. He's got.
We only did an hour the other day. We owe these people some time.
Terrion Arnold, number one. Quinyon Mitchell, number two. The only two corners he has clear slam dunk first round grades on, followed by Nate Wiggins. Three's got a first, second round grade on. Cooper DeJean, Kool-Aid McKinstry. Top slot corners, Mike Sanristil. At number six, who is receiving a second round grade.
All right. What about guys? Boy, I love Sanders still. I don't like the height on him, but I love everything else about him. When it comes to Andrew Phillips is a guy that we've talked quite a bit about. And Max Melton is another one that we've talked quite a bit about. It feels like it could be one of Sanristil, Phillips, Max Melton, depending on obviously round and how the board breaks and all.
Yeah, I mean, they brought those guys in for a visit. So obviously that's very much in play.
And obviously, there's no way Terrion Arnold falls, right?
I would put it unlikely, but not impossible. He's viewed as a 12th, 13th overall. If there's a bit of a board breakage in a certain way, I wouldn't call that the craziest thing in the world, but unlikely.
And I suppose Nate Wiggins too. I mean, that's a guy, at the pro day brought in for a visit. He's another one of that list that checks enough boxes to be 20th overall.
Yeah. Again, Wiggins, I think can't be ignored based. I mean, traditional Blues Clues would tell you that he's strongly in the running. But obviously, we know that Pittsburgh, is looking at offensive line more heavily, probably overall in terms of first round options than corner. But again, not going to rule Wiggins out if things break a certain way.
All right. Interesting. He's got, if you look at his big board overall, he's got Graham Barton at 18th overall. He's got Amarius Mims at 19th overall. He's got I'll roll down starting at like 17 here. Fuaga, okay. He's got 17. Barton, he's got 18th overall. Mims, he's got 19th. Let's see what else is notable. Jackson Powers Johnson, he's got 23rd overall. Wiggins, he's got 24th overall. Who else is Adonai Mitchell? He's got 33 overall. He's got Zach Frazier, 34th overall on his big board here. That's significant to the Steelers. As far as first round guys go, if we were to go off of his big board of the players that he has listed in the top, what do you want to cut it off at? 35?
Yeah, we can do that.
All right. Of those top 35 players, realistic selections for the Steelers. Boy, Fontenot would really have to drop because you got him night. But you'd have to probably say Fontenot, Terry and Arnold. And would they consider Fashanu out of Penn State?
Not less so on left tackle because they want to move Jones over to left tackle.
Latham has to be in the discussion.
Mm-hmm.
Fuago has to be in the discussion. Barton has to be in the discussion. Mims has to be in the discussion. Powers Johnson in the discussion. Wiggins in the discussion. And Mitchell in the discussion. And Zach Frazier. But Zach Frazier, that feels rich for Frazier at 20. And we've said that for a while now. So, I mean, there's a good, what do we name off, six or seven names there. And really, they're the same names we've kind of talked about, you know, overall there that I think the Steelers' first-round pick will come out of.
Yeah, and even with Mitchell, I mean, if he's there, it's certainly a conversation point. But there's not been a lot of pre-draft interest shown. No pro day and no visit that we're aware of so far. So, again, to me, if you want to make the exclusion to the con, you know, head coach GM pro day rule, I get that, but I think that guy will have to come in for a visit. I don't think they're going to take a first rounder that they've not really had a long sit down interview with beyond, you know, 18 minutes at the combine or a Senior Bowl meeting. I don't think that's enough for Pittsburgh to pull the trigger on a first round guy.
I would agree.
All right, Dave, any other final thoughts? We got this draft book is huge. And so we're just trying to go through it here on the fly. It dropped this morning. So we can talk about it more. Come Monday show, but that's a good primer of where I think Brugler is putting some guys and some insight there indirectly towards Pittsburgh.
All right. What do we got another 10 minutes here, right? Before we hit 2 hours,
get some read emails really quickly, do one or two emails and close out today's show.
All right. Boy, we've been all over the place this morning. Grant Kenny writes in, that's a new name. Welcome, Grant. Hey, David Ox, you guys rock. No disrespect to what you do during the regular season, but I always look forward to your off-season coverage because it is so detailed and vast. Thank you for that, Grant. He says, my question is more about connecting the dots with what Arthur Smith potentially might look for in an offensive lineman and how that could potentially increase some chances for prospects in a draft. For example, is someone like JPJ, Jackson Powers Johnson, a better scheme and height weight fit compared to other offensive line prospects for what the new OC looks for? Hope that makes sense. This can help us narrow the potential choices for the O-line prospects and what the draft choice could be. Keep putting on all the tinfoil hats and going down all the rabbit holes, he said. Boy, we went through quite a few of them today, Grant. What would you say about the connecting the dots with what Arthur Smith potentially might look for in an offensive lineman?
Yeah, there's been some studies done by Clayton, by Jeremy, that's kind of highlighted that. I don't know if there's one distinct takeaway from it. You want athletes, you want guys who can move and work on that track in this wide zone scheme where, yes, I'm sure Smith will, you know, run a variation of things. We discussed that after the hire. He's not exclusively a wide zone type of guy, but it is something that's, you know, among his bread and butter, his day one install type of stuff. And so you better be able to move, better be able to get on that track. So does that lend itself a bit more towards a Barton than, say, a Powers Johnson? It may, but I don't know if anyone gets truly eliminated based off what we know with Arthur Smith. I don't know if there's one guy we can sit there and say, oh, they're not going to take that guy because he's just so obviously not a scheme fit. I don't think that prospect really exists.
Especially when it comes to center in the top three, I would think. really, and tackle too. I mean, you want somebody with length. You want somebody that can move, that kind of thing there. How would you rank Barton, Jackson Powers Johnson, and Frazier if you were forced to do so with what you know about Arthur Smith?
Yeah, it's, I mean, the question with Barton is just the projection aspect of it. Do you believe he can pick up playing center and do so at a high level? I mean, if you answered yes to that, I think Barton is number one. And then from there, I think it's a little tightly bunched between Powers Johnson and Frazier. If again, if there are some medical concerns with Powers Johnson, then you have to consider that. I don't know where I would go with Powers Johnson and Frazier. But I think if Barton, if you said he could play center, then he's your number one.
Okay. All right. Let's see. Let's go to Brian Tolini. We are 15 days away prior to the start of the league year. Jeremiah Trotter Jr. was a name that was easy to connect to the Steelers. Once Patrick Queen was signed, he became an afterthought. With the Steelers showing quite a bit of interest in inside linebackers in the pre-draft process, have we crossed Trotter off the list too soon? He says, my original thinking was that Trotter would be a round two guy, but for the most part, consensus seems to be that he goes in the 70 to 90 range in the third round. He says, mock draft database has him at 81st overall. My question is, if he's available in that range, do you see the Steelers making that move, or is that too much of a luxury pick with our many needs? Do you feel the skill set pairs with Patrick Queen? Boy, funny how time, when you start off this process, and as another, as we talked in that last email, people saying, why did these things seem to shift? You know, it's because the tape catches up with initial rankings, those kind of things there. Where does he have?
I just pulled it up. It's interesting. Number seven, off linebacker, a fourth round grade.
Right.
Jeremiah Trotter.
So we went from a guy that was originally projected maybe as the Steelers pick at 20th overall in the first round to now a fourth round grade on him there. Now the Steelers have looked. The Steelers are going to draft an inside linebacker. Mm-hmm. I never bet my house on these kind of things, but I mean, if the Blues Clues and the Holcomb injury and just the room as a whole screams that they will draft an inside linebacker. It also screams that they will not take one in the first, second, I don't know, third.
Yeah, third round. Yeah, maybe that second third round pick at 98.
Yeah, I don't know if you can completely rule that out. I would say from where I sit right now, I'd be a bit surprised if that happened. I don't think you can rule it out completely, though. I guess the question is if he was sitting there, depending on how the board broke. If let's say a Trevon Wallace was off the board, who they obviously went, they went and saw at the pro day. Who was another one? I mean, they were at the Cedric Gray pro day, right?
Yeah, it was Eichenberg and Chambers at Ohio State. Eichenberg, probably the higher prospect. Gray at North Carolina and Wallace at Kentucky was where Curry was at.
All right.
Now Terrell Austin was at the Clemson pro day.
Right. So. Right. I mean,
that's for multiple people, but Trotter's one of them.
I guess his question is can you completely rule out Jeremiah Trotter being drafted by the Steelers in, let's say, the third? What do they have after the third?
119, and then not again until the sixth round, I think at 178.
Okay. I mean, I don't think you can rule it out.
No, it's a really good point, and we should consider that more because Trotter was not the prospect he was viewed when this draft process started 4 months ago. So, yeah, I mean, I would, you know, we know that Curry looked at the other linebackers, but yeah, I mean, he's 21. If he's fourth round sitting there, I'm not going to rule that out. It's a really good point.
Right. I just, one of the main takeaways here is that, boy, you know, just a few months ago, he was pegged 20th overall, and I think we even have a couple mocks on up on the draft, early offseason mocks, which would maybe him potentially being the pick. But he won't be the pick at 20th overall. But the question does become, if he's sitting there in the third, you know, late third, fourth, you know, could he be the guy? And you cannot rule that out. Let's go to Bryson Beery, another new name here. David Ouch, keep up the good work. Quick question regarding O-line position flexibility. In loom of the Steelers putting Kevin Dotson out of his normal position and playing Broderick Jones at right tackle, what is the best example of a lineman playing at a high level out of position for the Steelers, if any? Thank Bryson. Boy, what a creative question there. And the first name that comes to mind in reading this of a best example of a lineman playing out of high level at a high level out of position for the Steelers, if any, would be one Ramon Foster.
I was gonna say I think we're going to the Alan Faneca year we played left tackle, but I guess you're talking about like long term for a career. I was thinking Foster too. But it's like it's also hard where it's you sit there and say, was that his natural, was that his best position? And they just moved him to his best position. But obviously he was a college tackle at Tennessee. Yeah, I think Foster's a good one. Who else would even be in that discussion though? Trying to think about other names.
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to think. I mean, didn't Max Starks get flipped? What was Max in Florida? Do you remember?
Probably was a left tackle when you're just that massive. That's probably a good guy to put at left tackle. That's a good question.
When he broke in, he was right tackle with the Steelers. Mm-hmm. You know,
yeah, he played both.
Flipped there, but I can't remember what he even was at Florida. He might have played both at Florida. I can't remember back that far there.
Foster's a good name though.
Yeah. I mean, Foster is the guy that when I read that, because Foster wasn't he a right tackle primarily at Tennessee?
And I think they moved him around. Even Pittsburgh, he was a bunch of things initially, right?
Well, when he came out, I thought some of his initial snaps was at right tackle.
Yeah, no, he played because he was like a swing guy to begin his career. He wasn't just a left guard. He was playing, I think, both guard spots and some tackle, and then before settling in at left guard.
Now, is there anybody else in recent? The only other guy that I can, and it's not significant whatsoever, I don't think. And this guy's already out of the league, not gonna jump up on anybody's radar. But there's a small sample size. But BJ Finney was a much better left guard than he ever was a center.
That's a good one. That's a good one.
And once again, we're talking about what, three starts or something like that, and. But the limited amount of tape that BJ Finney, especially in games that he had started at left guard for the Steelers, he was a much better left guard than he ever was a center, in my opinion. And once again, it's such a small sample size. You don't know what that elongates to and all like that. But
sure.
that would probably be in recent history one that I would put on the board there.
Yeah, it's interesting. I was trying to think. Marcus Gilbert played a lot of right tackle at college in Florida, so he really wouldn't count. I think Foster is probably the best name you can mention.
At least in recent times here, and I'm talking the last, 15 years or so along those lines there.
Yeah.
Let's see. Justin Smith. Hello from Wyoming. Am I the only one not completely freaked out by the wide receiver room we currently project to have? He says, it seems like most analysts feel like the sky is falling in regards to that position group since the DJ trade. While I love DJ, I'm of the opinion that he wasn't irreplaceable, especially given this deep wide receiver class. He says, do you think we are really in a worse situation than last year with Pickens, a first to third round rookie, Van Jefferson, Calvin Austin, and Cordell Patterson? All due respect, Justin, and that's a new name from Wyoming as well, too. I'd like to go to Wyoming, visit Wyoming. George Pickens, you know what you have in him. A first or third round rookie, you obviously hope that you hit on something there. The rest of what he has listed here in Van Jefferson, Calvin Austin, and Patterson, for starters, can Cordell Patterson play wide receiver for you in a pinch? The answer is yes, but I don't think you build the room around that. No. Calvin Austin, you've got such a small sample size there. I mean, obviously you hope to be able to get him on the field for 300 or so snaps, or maybe even a little bit. I think you're trying to push it. Something's probably happened if you play him more than that. I mean, as much, what is Calvin Austin's claim so far in the NFL? A couple down the middle long receptions, right?
well, really one against the Raiders, the 72-yarder.
Drew a PI in the other, right?
Yeah, I guess you're right. But in terms of actual receptions, yeah, it's like two plays downfield.
I mean, isn't that really what, outside of his return capabilities, isn't that the highlight on him so far?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
All right, so it's hard to, you know, other than seeing what else he can do on top of that into this next, and then Van Jefferson. I mean, Van Jefferson's got to earn a roster spot.
Oh yeah, yeah. There's certainly no guarantee on him.
So, Justin, I think it's okay to be freaked out about that wide receiver room, at least until you find out who this draft pick's going to be.
Yeah, as you like to say, Dave, it's a good point. We'll see how the whole class looks. But yeah, I mean, they certainly took a big hit, trading Deontay Johnson away and leaving a big void there, and we'll see how they fill it.
All right. We've run 2 hours here, so we've got through quite a few emails here overall. It's a good time to end this, I think.
Yep. Come back on Friday and see if there's more visitors and go from there.
All right. In the meantime, you can follow me on Twitter/X at Steelers Depot. Follow Alex at Alex_Kozora. Follow the show at Terrible Podcast. Email the show, theterriblepodcast@gmail.com. If you like what we're doing, want to donate to the cause, SteelersDepot.com. Hit the donate button. Also, if you like an ad-free version of the site, SteelersDepot.com. Hit the ad-free button. Follow the directions that way. We'll be back on Friday. We'll talk more about any more pre-draft visitors. Obviously, talk about some more draft candidates here. Talk about, we'll see if they sign anybody, pre-draft visitors, all that good stuff. So we should not be at a shortage of things to talk about. We'll have another roundtable here with some of the guys, contributors, at some point before the draft. So look forward to that. We're trying to get that scheduled next. So until Friday, as always, thanks for listening to the Terrible Podcast with Dave and Alex.